You're listening to Voices of Your Village, and today I got to hang out with Ed Center to chat about sharing our cultural traditions without passing on trauma. There are so many things from our childhood that we might want to pass on, and so many that we might not, and sometimes these get muddled and mixed, and we might wonder, like, how do we separate some parts of this? What does it look like to parent kids who are experiencing a lot of trauma or who have experienced trauma? We got to chat about so many things in this episode that were so rich. I wish I just had more time with Ed. He's the founder of The Village Well Parenting, and it's a community where parents come to learn skills that nurture the parent-child relationship, heal intergenerational wounds, and discover ancestral wisdom that allows parents to remain rooted in their own sacred cultures. Ed is doing such incredible work in this world, and it's a true gift to get to learn from him. I'm really jazzed to get to share this episode with you. All right, folks, let's dive in. Hey there, I'm Alyssa Blass Campbell. I'm a mom with a master's degree in early childhood education and co-creator of the Collaborative Emotion Processing Method. I'm here to walk alongside you through the messy, vulnerable parts of being humans raising other humans with deep thoughts and actionable tips. Let's dive in together. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Voices of Your Village podcast. Today, I get to hang out with Ed Center, a new friend of mine, and the founder of The Village Well Parenting, a community where parents come to learn skills that nurture the parent-child relationship, heal intergenerational wounds, and discover ancestral wisdom that allows parents to remain rooted in their own sacred cultures. I dig that so much. The Village Well is for any parent who desires to share the beauty of their own cultural traditions without passing along its trauma. What a doozy. What a doozy you've taken on here, Ed.
Ed, that work is so hard to do.
It's so hard. How do we just pass on the, as my friend Dr. Lynetta Willis calls them, the legacy blessings and not the legacy burdens?
I love that language. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, it's real hard.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is. Thank you for helping guide us in how to do this.
I don't know if I'm guiding, but I definitely have some thoughts.
Yeah, cool. I dig it. I'm excited to dive into those thoughts. And Ed is the dad of two humans, not as tiny as the rest of our village over here, of a 12 and a 6-year-old over there.
That's right.
Yeah, Brad. That's right. Rad, well, I hope to get to learn from you in this parenting space too. I have a 2.5-year-old and I'm growing another tiny human right now and forever trying to learn.
Well, I will say this. There are a lot of parallels between toddlers, tweens, and teens, because these are phases in life where kids, if they have good if they are grounded in their sense of belonging and connection, they are seeking more significance. Mm-hmm. And that significance comes out in often very painful autocratic ways, right? And so while the so they're craving the same thing, of course, how we parent and meet those needs is very different, but there are a lot of similarities. But I digress and jump in too soon.
No, I dig that. Thank you. And I think it's so true. And they don't ask for it or communicate it in the ways that we often would desire.
Not at all.
We might say.
Yes.
Rat. So one thing that I'm super intrigued by, you said you did foster to adopt with both of your children.
Yeah. So first I want to say something, because I know you have lots of education folks here, and I'm an educator.
Yeah.
So my name is Ed Center.
Yes.
And that can be very confusing. So Edward William Center is my actual name. But most people in education the first time confuse me for a building or a department or something like that. So here I am with a weird name to have in education.
Yes, so funny.
Yes. Yes. And my husband, Chris, and I, we've been together for 20 years next year.
Wow. And incredible.
Thank you. And we adopted our first child 12 years ago. Well, he's 12. So we adopted, actually, we're in a transition between he and them. So I'm making that transition. So they were adopted when they were 6 months old.
Okay.
And through foster adopt. And 6 years after that, we had what I call an unplanned gay pregnancy.
The most intrigued.
The way that worked is we were kind of mildly considering having a second child, and we decided that we were going to have a girl, and it was going to be a girl of color. And so we were thinking about preparing for that, and then we got a call from the city of San Francisco, a social worker saying, hey, we have this Caucasian baby boy, he's 6 weeks old. And she starts, you know, continuing. I said, hold up. Why are you contacting me? We're thinking about having a girl. And she said, oh, I forgot to say, he's the biological brother of your older son.
You're like, oh, there goes my plan. Right.
And so we met him the next day, which was a Wednesday. And then on Thursday, the nurses said, okay, we're going to release him to you on Friday. And I said, okay, everybody, slow down. I need to go out with the boys one more time. I need to go to Babies R Us, pick up some things.
We need some stuff.
Right. And then on Monday, he moved in with us. So it was really cool. Yeah, I remember having a conversation with my boss at the time saying, so I'm pregnant. Like very, very pregnant.
Like my water just broke.
Yes. 100%. And fortunately, I had a very supportive workplace that figured out how to give me maternity leave in an instant.
I love that.
Yeah, it was a great journey.
Sweet. So I'm so intrigued here, specifically around like how this ties in to your work. Because one thing that I find overwhelming is the foster care system and the, you know, for my work in emotional development, the SET method has five components. One's adult child interactions, but the other four are about us. And so much of it is like our cultural narratives and our social experiences and how we were raised and all that jazz, and how that then plays into who we are and how we show up and what our triggers are and what our trends are. And so when I look at the foster care system, it feels overwhelming to me to be like, oh shoot, like how are we going to support these kids who at the baseline are going to experience challenges with attachment? And then through that, like are going to have multiple different cultural narratives based on like, I don't know, how many foster families have they been in and what does their journey look like versus a kid who's in one home for their life? And you can be like, yeah, maybe I can't trace back all my things, but like, I know certain things that are then harder. So I am so curious to learn about like your work and how it pulls into this.
So I can tell our story with that, which is that because we adopted both kids as babies, we were under the illusion that the damage done and the hardships that they've experienced would be lessened because we got them soon. And so all of these challenges, so they didn't experience, say, lives of abuse and neglect.
Totally.
Right. But now we know how early infancy trauma really affects the wiring of the brain. Right. And so just the loss of the birth mother is a huge factor. But then my kids had other complications related to poverty and addiction, et cetera, et cetera. And so they were born in emergency right? Yes. Very different from, hello, we've been waiting for you. We're so excited that you're here, in this kind of calm, welcoming environment. And I can now see how that emergency impacted the wiring of their brains.
Yes, right? This. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
And yes. And so that has been and continues to be the challenge that we've taken on in supporting our kiddos. So because I am an educator, I was also under the illusion that I had all of these skills and tools.
Totally. We right? do that to ourselves as teachers. Right, we're like, right. We've got this.
Yeah. And also, like, I've loved other people's children many times. Totally. And so this is partially why we chose the adoption path. We, and I felt like I have, you know, ADHD, like all these other, bring it. Yeah. I got it. I did not have it.
It turns out I don't have it.
Right. And the main reason I didn't have it is because our own triggers come up with our own children in a way that is more intense, more severe, quicker than it does with other people's children. Right. Right? And so I was baffled by my inability to stay calm and grounded and logical with one kid's behavior. When you give me 25 teenagers acting crazy and I got it, I'm thriving.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
And so that was really confusing to me.
This is such an important note. When we look at this, like, it makes sense, right? The same mm-hmm. as a teacher, where I could take on somebody else's baby crying, other like yep. kids slap me across the face, right? Like, I'm not like, oh, I can't wait to hang out with you in this moment. But I'm also not like, oh my God, I like am a rage filled. Who am I raising? What is this going to mean for you down the road? Who are you going to be as a 16-year-old? Are you going to get kicked out of school? Are you ever going to have friends? Are you going to get a job, right? Like, I can spiral so fast with my own kid in a way that with other kids, I didn't. I was like, yeah, it's 18 months old, and sometimes 18 month olds hit because they don't know what else to do, right? Like, it's so rational to me when it's somebody else's kid. And then when it's mine, it's that fast forward projection of who are you? Who am I raising? Am I failing? Right? Like, those narratives. And then what does this mean about me?
And what does this mean about me?
Yes.
Is the important question.
Yes.
Right? So let me go into kind of what happened and how I got into parent coaching and parent education and the formation of the Village Well, right? So when we were in the early pandemic, so schools had shut down, we were home, we were trying to figure out what to do. And again, my illusions, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm an educator, I have one kid, and I'm, of course, going to be able to support him in his studies and virtual teaching. What we didn't know is that he has ADHD and dysgraphia, which if it's dyslexia for writing.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Can you give me an example of how that would show up?
Yes. He reads at grade level. He reads really well. Okay. He enjoys books.
Uh-huh. And okay.
If you ask him to write a two sentences, he really struggles to do that.
Got it. Okay. Right? Thank you.
And so because of that, virtual learning was not going to work, sure. right? Particularly in that early phase where teachers didn't really know what they were doing either. Sure. But I'm an educator. And so I pushed him, and I thought he was being sassy at first and willful. And as he pushed back, I leaned into the cultural scripts that I have around, you are pushing my boundaries and testing my authority. And so the strategies that I call upon are about squashing those attempts and showing you who is in control here.
Yeah. Let me power over real quick.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And one of the things that I have come to recognize is that from my family, we have a very absolute definition of respect for adults. Mm-hmm. And what I have realized for myself in my situation is that shows up in a way that I call toxic respect.
Yeah, right? Sure.
Where we are clinging so much to this ideal of power, authority, of appropriateness. Mm-hmm. That we're not actually seeing how is the behavior of this child communicating an unmet need.
Correct. Yeah. Right? It's that obedience culture, right?
Exactly.
Like, yeah. I grew up in it. I know it well, my friend. I know it well.
Yes. And even though I have worked to raise my kids in a different way, at times with success, when stuff hits the fan, mm-hmm. I go back to the behavior set from wounds that I have, right?
Sure.
And so we got into these awful power struggles. And what I didn't recognize is that his mental health was spiraling.
Yeah.
And I had a wake-up call one night when I told him that in order to get more television, he was going to have to brush his teeth. Sure. And that started a 2-hour screaming tantrum. They're 10 at the time. And during which they were throwing things, busted a hole in the wall, used vocabulary that I didn't know they had to insult me.
Sure.
And in that moment, I could see that this was no longer just defiance.
Yeah.
But I couldn't tap into any other strategies.
Sure.
And so I kept in his face and screaming at him and engaging in this full power struggle. And so I recognized at that point that my parenting was not meeting the moment and that I was going to need a different set of tools and skills and a new framework. And so the good news is that we got tons of mental health support for him. Right. Yeah. And so that started to really make things better. We found local agencies who are incredible, who people came to our house pre-vaccination to work with him, sometimes at 10 at night when stuff is really going down. Right. And so I am so indebted to those folks for helping to save our family. And that also gave me the space to look at my own parenting. And so I went out to find parenting coaches and found a lot of people with good information.
Sure.
Here's where it got tricky. All right. Everyone who I encountered was a white woman with a psychology degree or social, right?
Correct.
And I think what a lot of people don't understand about folks of color, many folks of color, let's say, right?
Sure.
And for myself as a brown man with, and also a queer man, is that we've been told our whole lives that the things that we do are wrong.
Correct.
Right. And that the way we do things are not appropriate.
And who you are is wrong.
Correct. Right. Mm-hmm. And I have, as an educator, I've been guilty of that too.
Sure.
Right. And so when all of these white women were telling me, you need to do this differently. You need to do this differently. You need to have more special time. You need to connect before you correct. Have you tried weighted blankets? Right. And all of these things. And I was like, yes, I'm doing special time for like 2 hours at a time, but that's not changing these behaviors. Right. Whoa. I'm even feeling my
radar. It's not making this child less defiant.
It's not.
Yeah. Right?
And and the trick was I was going to have to learn how to really get in touch with my own triggers and wounds. But I needed to do that in a way with a guide who wasn't didactic,
sure.
who wasn't judging my approaches, who could say, this behavior is wrong. And I know you want to punch him in the mouth.
Yep.
You're not going to punch him in the mouth. Instead, we're going to help you respond to the situation rather than react to it. And here's how we're going to help you do that, right?
Love
because
it.
You have every right to be angry. And
yes.
Right. That started my journey.
I love it. And I think this is something we were just talking about on the seed team the other day that I think, especially in the respectful parenting community, people are like, kids aren't defiant. They have a need, yada, yada. And it's like, well, actually both, right? Like the behavior is defiant, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's in an effort to try and meet this need, sure, but it is both. And so I think to be able to look at this, I have an upcoming workshop here with a local dad community. And it's only open to dads. And I love presenting for this community because I get totally different questions than most of my events where mostly women come out. Yeah. And one of the things that came up the last time I was presenting for this organization was a dad was like, listen, like this sounds, it makes total sense. Like, yeah, I want my kid to have these skills. And if they cry at school and then they get beat up, like then what? Like, then what do you have for me? And this was 5 years ago. And he asked this question. I was like, this makes total sense. That was his experience in his lens was if I cry at school, I'm going to get beat up and I can't be vulnerable there. Right. Like that's not a safe space for me to show up in this way.
Right.
And it, first of all, like was so good for me in that I, as a female, I can cry almost anywhere safely. And that's not true across the board. Yeah. And I then add, like, as a white woman, gosh, so I can do almost anything that I want to do apart from like maybe be alone with a male who's stronger than me and like feel safe. Right.
Right. And especially the range of emotions that you're allowed to express.
Oh my gosh.
There's a very big range, right?
I can't be angry. Right. Like there are some things that I can't be. Mm-hmm. Otherwise I'm a bitch or I'm whatever. And like those things. But like it was just like this moment where I was like, yeah, Alyssa, like this is so real. And I think when we focus so much on the like, how do we get this behavior to stop from kids? Mm-hmm. What we miss, and this is what like my favorite piece of data from the research of the SET method. So my colleague and I co-created collaborative motion processing method research across the US. It was that it wasn't a huge shift in kids' behavior. It was a change in the way the adults experienced the behavior.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that is my goal. That is my goal, is that like when there is this defiant behavior, we can see it and separate it and say like, yes, this behavior is defiant. I want to make it stop because I want this kid to be successful in life. And I learned that's how to be successful in life. And that all makes sense. And now I can see that this kid has a need, right? Like, how do we separate those two things?
Yeah.
Because both are true. The behavior is defiant. That's not going to get them very far in life under the lens that we know.
That's right.
They have a need.
Oh, hey, everybody. It's us, Blair and Molly, your old pals from Toddler Purgatory. Two moms who are also actors, who are also creative beings, who sometimes feel stuck.
And now we're back with a whole new podcast about unsticking it, launching in January. What happens when life gets in the way of our creativity instead of nourishing it?
We talk to all sorts of guests about how to break through the mucky, gluey, sticky wall that can get between you and your creativity. We hear about their journeys, their successes, their challenges, and even their bougie coffee shop orders.
So join us, won't you, as we deep dive into how to unstick ourselves from the life gunk that can get in the way of our creative freedom.
Get out of there, life gunk.
Let us help you get back to your best creative self. Look for Unsticking It with Blair and Molly.
Wherever you listen to podcasts, starting in January.
Unsticking It with Blair and Molly. Because sometimes life sucks.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.
And so what in my work I'm trying to do with myself first and then with other parents of color is to get to that same place that takes us first through a journey of unpacking.
Yes. Right?
What are the bits of cultural wisdom that show up in your values that are critical that your kids take on, right?
Totally.
And so for me, that's cousins as your first best friends, right? We had big Sunday suppers growing up. I lived in very close proximity to extended family. So every weekend dinner was a party. So now I'm gay. I've converted that to brunches.
Sure. Right? So,
the evolution, right? So what are, oh, outdoor play as sacred space.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is hard in a major city, but we figure it out. And so these are our values, and the values were often communicated explicitly. So we understand them and can explain them to our children.
Yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then we also have these wounds, which were taught to us implicitly. And so our understanding of them is murky, and they tend to come out when we're triggered. Right. And so what I have found, and this is not just with people of color, this is with everyone, is that many of us grow and understand some of our wounds and weaknesses.
Sure.
And then we hit this point in our early adulthood where we realize, you know what, I have this stuff, but I'm still able to navigate the world kind of okay.
Totally. Right?
Like I finished high school. I went to college. I'm holding down a steady job. I have friends who like me. Maybe I'm in an intimate relationship. And now I can look at anxious attachment, or that I get overwhelmed when I experience these certain things, and I can kind of navigate around it. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to put that in a box and I'm going to label it anxious attachment, overwhelmed when there's too much work, whatever. And I'm just going to put it on a shelf and I know it's there. Right. No. And then I'm going to continue to navigate the world. And then you have kids, and those kids crawl into that closet and they find that shelf and they take down those boxes and they smash it open.
Yep.
And then we can see how these things will be passed on if we don't decide to work on them. And then that is the opportunity for healing. And that is work that is deep and hard and continuous. And it's the work that's worth doing in order to stop intergenerational trauma or passing on these wounds to our kids.
I will also say, I don't think it's all that it's all looped in, like, this one is trauma, this one I have to heal. I think sometimes it's like, well, I do really want to raise kids who have respect for others, respect for themselves, respect still without the obedience part of respect, right? And so sometimes I feel like they're intertwined, where it's like, I really like this value that's then intertwined with this other value I was given that I don't really want to pass on. And the ability to, like, tease them apart and say, okay, in my definition of respect, or what I want to pass on as respect, looks like this, you know, looks like respect for our own bodies first, and our, maybe our household things or our family or the people around us, et cetera. But redefining what those values are, I think sometimes is a challenge. And I think we can get caught up in the, this is important, and not being able to then tease out, well, what parts of it feel important that we still hold and want to pass on. Does that make sense?
100%. They're always connected to something that is important or has worked for you in the past and maybe in the present, right? And so I was in a workshop a few weeks ago, and there was a woman who is a parent of two who told me that she was a foster kid.
Yeah.
And so now she has two kids. And first, I had to just congratulate, like, you went through some stuff and now you're here in a parenting workshop.
Yeah. Right. Look at you.
Incredible. Right.
Yeah.
And one thing that showed up for her is what we call fawn response.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right? I got it.
Yeah. Which is a new thing for me. I hadn't heard of this before a couple years ago, but most people have heard of fight flight, right? Mm-hmm. Fawn is when, for example, if you are a rabbit and the coyote, you try to run away from the coyote and you're cornered, and the rabbit decides, I'm going to make the coyote love me. So she doesn't eat me. Right.
Correct.
So it's a more common response in humans. Yeah.
Correct. And
but this woman in foster care, she talked about the fawn response. And I said right away, I said, are you the oldest?
Mm.
And she said, yes. And I said, did you feel like you had to keep your younger siblings safe? And she said, all the time. And I said, so this response makes sense because you were trying to keep everything okay so that there wasn't violence that would, in whatever form, that would hurt your younger siblings.
It's safe.
And, right? Right?
Yeah.
And what that has meant is that as an adult, you fear conflict, even when it comes from your kids. And so the desire is to make everything okay all the time. And that's not going to serve you all the time anymore. And so that's the space to explore. And it's not a defect.
No, in fact, it's very helpful.
It probably got you here.
Yes. It's how you probably survived.
Yes.
The fawn response actually reminds me of, do you watch The Office?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
There's a Pam Beasley quote in there where she's like something to the effect of like, I hate the idea that someone out there hates me. I even hate thinking that Al-Qaeda hates me. Like, I think if they got to know me, they wouldn't hate me. And it always reminds me of that. So I'm like, yeah, like if you just got to know me, I think we could love each other. You would love me. It would be great. But I think
that show was so damn inappropriate and I miss it so much.
Legit. But I think that especially as women, we fall into the fawn response as a coping mechanism quite a bit. And in the same way that I feel like we often kind of like societally train boys and men to fall into a fight response.
That's 100% right.
And so I think for women, like fawning, it's like, yeah, this is how I've gotten here. Like, I have people pleased my way to this point. And if I hadn't, I may not have gotten to this point. And I love that, like, respect for how you got here and that it's not about the like shame or blame for those parts of us. In fact, I want to turn to them with like gratitude and compassion.
And there are still parts of it that are beautiful, right? Like without knowing this woman, I'm like, you bring the best food to the potluck, don't you?
Correct.
And you show up with warmth. And I bet the other neighborhood kids love you. I bet your house is right. And she's like, how do you know all these things? Right? I'm like, I'm not a genius. I just understand how these things show up. And so what's now going to be really hard is to extricate these things that are really beautiful and you should keep doing, but also how do you hold firm boundaries?
Yes.
That is not something that you have had the chance to focus on yet.
Right.
And your kids need that from you. So totally. How do we do that? Right.
They need to see that conflict is okay. Right. And like, how do we within ourselves learn that conflict is okay? Mm-hmm. One of my most common triggered responses is flee. I can run like there's no tomorrow. Mm-hmm. I experienced some significant trauma when I was 14 and I studied abroad when I was 15 to Austria for 6 months. And everyone was like, wow, look at you go. Right. And it's like, oh no, trauma response, like just running away. And I'm so good at it. But then in parenthood, it can show up sometimes as like, I'm here, but I have left. And on the outside to everyone else, it looks like I'm being this calm, present parent and I'm holding space. And on the inside, it's, oh no, I have disconnected from this situation right now because what I really want to do is just like actually leave. And turns out you can't just like leave a 2.5-year-old by themselves at a grocery store or whatever. So I will just like disconnect in the moment.
And
emotionally flee. I flee in whatever way I can. But on the outside, it looks to everybody else, it's like the pro-social behavior, right? Like it looks like I am being this like really present, kind parent and actually like, no, I can't hold space for your stuff right now. Right. And my nervous system reaction just usually isn't to fight.
And I also think it's important, right? Because while you are able to hold that calm space, I bet you are not projecting to your kiddo that I can be comfortable with all your emotions.
Absolutely not. We are disconnected.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he feels that, or like same in partnership. My husband will feel that of like, we are disconnected now, but on the outside to people who don't know what's happening, it just like, it looks more acceptable.
Right. Right. And then the other tricky space, as you will find when your kiddo is old enough so that you can actually leave, what is the difference between taking healthy space mm-hmm. to take care of yourself and formulate a plan with your frontal lobe rather than your amygdala and checking out all the time.
Correct.
And that's tricky. And yeah. my husband and I have these conversations all the time. Like, are you just abandoning us for a while? Or is this walk actually helping you? And yeah. you're going to be able to come back and re-engage? And why is this walk taking 45 minutes? Right? Like all of these things.
Yes. Yeah. It is so tricky. And then to not, you know, pass that on. We're like, my child also, he's either freeze or flee usually are his two. And so when I see him fleeing, that part of me that knows what that's like actually wants to go with him and rescue him. Right. I'm like, no, don't flee. Like, I know what you're doing. You don't have to, right. Like that gets activated when I see it in him. And yeah, it's so tricky to navigate. So I guess what I'm curious about here too, is this is all very tricky to navigate when it's biological children and we know their whole background and there isn't that attachment right from the beginning separation piece. And so when we're looking at this and we're looking at foster or foster to adopt or adoption, one of the things that I'm so curious about is unpacking the intergenerational trauma for ourselves that we're like, all right, as their parent, what do I want to pass on? What do I not want to pass on, et cetera? And then also looking at like, I don't know what else they came to us with, right? Like, I don't know what they experienced in the womb. I don't know any of that part to know, like, how do I unpack that with them?
Yeah. Yeah. So I've found that it's actually simpler than I would have thought. That doesn't mean it's easy. I don't want to get those things confused.
Yeah,
right. Good. But as a parent, my parenting script, both the wisdom and the wounds, like those are mine. Those are mine to understand and to hold, and also understand that I'm going to pass elements of these on to my kiddos. Right. And so can I be conscientious to undo some of the wounds part, right? It's not all going to happen.
Correct. Right? Dr. Lynetta Willis, who I had just referenced at the beginning, the likes I think you would dig her. She's a Black therapist who does work in this intergenerational healing. And she describes it as a relay race where it's like passing a baton and you're going to pass some stuff on. You're going to run your leg. You're going to pass a baton. Hopefully we're healing some things in our leg, but then we're passing stuff on. Like it's not our job to heal it all.
Right. Right. And so I'm really intentional, for example, because I grew up feeling responsible for my mother's feelings. Right. And so I'm really conscientious of trying not to pass that on. Right. Mm-hmm. There's other stuff that I don't even know what it is that I'm definitely passing on.
Correct.
Right? So like, let's be clear about that. But in general, I will say that is my story, my piece to own. Right. Mm-hmm. And the other part around my kids' story and the beauty of their cultural scripts and their biological family history, as well as the tough parts, for the most part, we are talking about that with them with our rational brains.
Yes.
Right. And so we're not in a triggered space when we do that.
Yeah.
There are still tricky questions, right? Because I will say for both of my kids right now at 6 and 12, the adoption story we told them when they were very younger was a true age-appropriate adoption story, right? And so big people problems contained a lot of stuff that we didn't go into detail in terms of their birth parents, right? And it is now appropriate, particularly for my older one, to go into what some of those big people problems are.
Yeah.
Right. And particularly his, we have contact with his birth dad, who is interested in meeting them. And we're excited about that too. And there are certain things we need to make sure are in place before that meeting happens, like coming to this meeting sober and right. And all of these things. And we feel optimistic about it, but we also feel like we need to let our older kiddo know more of the story.
Yeah.
So they understand what some of those complications mean so that they can better show up to meet their bio dad. And so but we're doing all of that with thoughtfulness, logic. We have time on our hands, right? We don't have to have that conversation at any given time.
Totally.
And so it makes that process, it's still a challenge, but it's not complex for me.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes sense that when you're having those conversations, it's almost like that one's not about me, right? Mm-hmm. Like all these mm-hmm. other ones, it's like, this is about me. And then it's mm-hmm. so complex because mm-hmm. those parts of us come up. And this one, you can really do kind of from that outside a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense to me. That makes total sense to me. And I think recognizing that there's going to be, we joke in my household of like, I wonder what Sage will be in therapy for, right? Like my 2.5-year-old, not like, will he be in therapy? But like, I want him to know therapy is an option. And I think it's rad and great. And like, I wonder what he'll bring to the table. And that like, we are, as we are passing along some of these burdens of our own that we don't even know about or haven't healed yet, and these like legacy blessings parts, that then as they move through a different cultural context, like some of them will be applicable and some of them won't, you know, that like maybe what today feels like this will be a really supportive tool for them to have in 20 years isn't anymore.
That's right.
And I think that ability to cultivate a household where it's safe to just have these conversations is such a key part of healing intergenerational trauma, especially with our kids.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down,
or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.
Are you overwhelmed by the things that get in the way of you doing what you want to do? Are you looking for ways to simplify life to better align with your values? Do you want to create space in your schedule so you have room for more of the good stuff? Play, joy, relationships, gratitude, and more? If you answered yes to any of these questions, I invite you to check out Edit Your Life, a podcast to help you edit the unnecessary from your life so you have more room to enjoy the awesome. Through episodes with me, Christine Coe, and a range of super smart, compassionate, and thoughtful guests, you'll come away with big picture insights and practical ways to declutter your home, schedule, and mental space without getting bogged down by perfection. I have always believed that small moments and actions matter tremendously. My goal is to help you find agency and space in your life through doable baby steps that will leave you feeling accomplished instead of overwhelmed. Check out Edit Your Life wherever you enjoy your podcasts.
I think having a place where you can have these conversations, where you can talk openly and sometimes with humor about the challenges. And then I also think it's vital to extend it beyond your household.
Correct.
Right? Like I've come to the realization that nuclear families suck.
Yeah.
It's really challenging. And something that I've talked about with particularly other, and this is again not exclusive to families of color, but many of us grew up without a bunch of financial resources.
Yeah.
And part of that was we grew up in environments connected to extended family.
Yes.
And so I grew up, you know, walking distance from 20 relatives or so.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And then I have achieved a certain amount of definitely education success and then financial success related to that. And now I'm living this nuclear family life. And there's a big cost to that.
Huge. Huge. Yeah.
And so why did these things become intertwined? And so for us, that has meant really pulling in Chosen Family, which queers are all about. Thankfully,
totally.
Right. Yep. And so we have folks with who are not going to have children, both gay and straight and other, who we've invited in as Chosen Family, and they have time, love, and financial resources that they want to lean into a relationship with our kiddos with. And we really benefit from that. And as part of that, having adopted folks, right? So adults who were adopted, be able to bring in a different perspective. So I have a friend who has told me the "you're not my real dad" shout is coming. You have him call Auntie Jody when that happens.
Yep.
I will be here and I will deal with that one for you, because you shouldn't have to deal with that one on your own. I said, okay, thank you. I'll have you on speed dial, right?
But it's so awesome. I there's so much to unpack here. So I grew up in a low income community, and my parents started having kids at 19 with no college degrees, and there's five of us and all that jazz. But I grew up down the road from my grandparents, and my aunt was down the road, and in a small community. I think one thing that like small towns do so well is community. That I don't think that small towns are always great at seeing outside of their own community, that like we should support outside of that, or have any sort of,
or even if you're divergent in any way, right? Like
it's interesting though, because I found in our community, like you could be divergent within that community, but if you were outside of that, no, right? Like I grew up in a town where it was predominantly like white Christian. You could be queer though. Like that, there were a number of queer families in the town that I grew up in. I have friends that like now, then I went to college and like most of my college friends had hetero parents. And growing up, I had a number of friends that had queer parents. And it was, but it was anyway, all this to say, like, I feel like the small town, at least in my experience of it, was like, oh, everyone takes care of each other here in this small town. They don't necessarily take care of folks outside of their small town, like, but you really can, like, you need bread, you need eggs, you need somebody to watch your kids, you need to tap into this, like there's a fire at somebody's house, like everyone comes together, you know, like there, you don't need a GoFundMe for it because the whole town's going to pool whatever.
Social capital.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
It's incredible.
Exactly.
I also think what you just said is really fascinating, and I have in terms of like being different within a community.
Yeah.
And I think that's at least a chapter in your next book.
Yeah, cool.
There's some cool exploration to be had there.
Yeah, I think that, but then also what you were bringing in here was like, then we've moved into this like nuclear space, right? So I moved from that small town to Burlington, Vermont, and we moved to be near my husband's mom and her wife live a mile down the road from us. It's awesome, but he's an only child. And so our like, nuclear family plus then my mother's-in-law, that was it, that's it here. And so we had to really branch out into like we call them family, our friends as family, and they have made up like our village. And I think it's so huge for us then raising kids if we're only raising kids within our family context, like with my grandparents down the road, my aunt, etc., then we're still passing on a lot of the same stuff. It's hard to really heal that. It's being reinforced over and over in different, from different humans, right? Versus like, my child is going to get a little bit of whatever Francesca's bringing to the table and whatever, but they have different cultural contexts. And because we're not all from the same family, we have different, does that make sense?
I mean, I called my organization The Village Well, because I think that both thriving and healing happen in community. And
100%.
So I do take on one-on-one, or usually one-on-family, right, coaching clients. it's honestly not my favorite work. My favorite work is bringing people together around a theme, toddlers, adoption, queer families, whatever the thing is, to create spaces where I'll provide focus, right? So here's some tools, here's some ways to heal, etc. But it's really the connection and the power of being together in those spaces that I think brings the best healing towards best parenting.
Well, then I think it brings new perspective. You know, that like I get to lean on the wisdom, the legacy blessings from my like then family, the friends that we have surrounded as family, and learn from their legacy blessings. And I'm like, oh shoot, like that's how some people are raised. Cool. Like I like that, you know? And also then get to see some of their legacy burdens and be like, oh, cool. That makes sense to me too. And I'm gonna try and not pass that one on, you know, like, but I get to like learn from different cultural backgrounds by being in a space where it's not all people I'm related to that I've surrounded myself with.
Yeah. So what I have found is that I have been privileged to be in multiple spaces where there are thoughtful parents who are willing to be vulnerable and share and laugh about our experiences, right?
Yeah.
What I'm trying to shift with the Village Well is the process often stops there, right? Mm. We share, we connect, and we and leave the conversation at that. Can it then move into what are we going to do to shift our practices to heal, and how can we support and hold each other accountable for that? And I have been in fewer spaces like that organically.
Totally.
And so that's what I try to cultivate in the work that I do with groups of families.
I think that's so rad because I think you're right. Like, I think you're right. Like it's really, it's easier to vent about it than it is to do the next steps. And I love to vent about it. It's a real cozy place to be.
But to a then glass of wine and a good vent. I mean, come on.
Let's go. But then to do those next steps is harder. And I think it even just like challenging the nuclear family model to say like, oh yeah, we do sleepovers with my friend Francesca and Hillary. They have two kids and they will do sleepovers with the kids, like all of us, the whole the whole gang. And when I had like shared about this at one point on social media and somebody was like, you just like do sleepovers at your friend's house, like with your kids, like the kids and the parents. And I was like, yes. And I think that like for us, it's finding the time to go beyond the conversation into the practice part and having times where like, all of our kids are asleep versus like our half conversation of like, oh yeah, there's this toddler needs this. And then this 4-year-old's asking for this and this 6-year-old, whatever. And like, you're being pulled in all these directions, that having that time is what for me has led to the like practical application part of like, how, all right, now what do we do? Is that it's the time. And I have really, truly, because it's so, I think so hard to like, at least for us, find time where like everybody has a sitter and we can like sit down kid free in that sense versus like, we're going to be able to hang for a weekend. And there's going to be moments of like nap time or sleep times or whatever, or the kids are playing, where we have time to actually have more conversation versus we're going to have a play date for an hour and a half.
That's so beautiful and so important. And what a privilege that you have that family, right? And can really lean into those like intensives, if you will, on a sleepover weekend.
It's so cool. Yeah, they had come to, when they had their first kid, they come to one of my workshops and their little one was maybe 4 months old. And then I ran into them. It's Burlington, Vermont, where it's like basically a small town. I ran into them maybe a month later and they were like, hi, we would like to be your real life friend. and I was like, thank you for your vulnerability. Like, same, let's do this. And they ended up becoming best friends of ours here now. But I think it's also like hard to cultivate that where you have to be able to say like, hi, I'm going to be so awkward and say something like, I would like to be your real life friend.
This reminds me of these conversations that I would have in my 20s. And so there's
with other gay guys and I wanted to be their friend. Yeah. But like, how do you say that when there's also the possibility of a and how do you say, I want to be your friend, I'm kind of asking you out, but I'm not asking you out romantically, but I don't want you to think that I'm fully not attracted to you, because your answer,
I think, like, you're a lovely you human that? But will you just will be my friend
you do that?
Oh, I love that. Yeah, that's literally what it was. And like, thank goodness they had the vulnerability or exercised the vulnerability to be awkward in that moment, because it worked, you know. But I think that's part of the like village part of doing this work collectively, is that it's vulnerable to enter into these relationships.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of us, vulnerability wasn't safe.
Right. Right. And I have heard that over and over, particularly from women of color.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And totally. I think particularly with the cultural influence of Brené Brown, and I love me some Brené Brown. Mm-hmm. Right. But like, how do I show up with that kind of vulnerability and not have it weaponized against me?
Yeah.
Is something that I hear a lot. And we do see, you know, here, horror stories, if you will, around mothers of color. I'm thinking in particular of the homeless woman who said her address was in a neighborhood so that her kid could go to better schools, mm-hmm. and was arrested for that. And like, one, how does a homeless woman get penalized for having an address somewhere when they're homeless, right? But also, mm-hmm. like, middle class people do this stuff all the time.
Also, like, right. pause and just, like, what's our goal here?
Yeah.
What's the goal here?
Yeah.
You know, can we just, I am a human who, like, I only follow rules if I agree with them. Yes. And mostly from the point of, like, what's the point of this? Yes. Right. And, like, that's what comes up for me in that story is, like, what is the goal? Is the goal that this child gets to have access to education and supports and services and everything that every child deserves? Great. What's the problem?
I have a question for you. Is your husband a rule follower?
Oh, hell yeah.
Because I'm the rule bender and my husband is the rule follower.
Yeah.
And it creates this really interesting dynamic. Right.
Oh my God. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Oh. And like, there are so many times I'm like, he'll be really proud of himself for like pushing a boundary or like not. And I'm like, yeah, wow, way to go, bud. Like, it's like the smallest little thing that he like did. And that for me is like, I wouldn't have even counted that one for myself.
Right.
Yeah.
So exactly. Real. We go to this beautiful lake in Northern California at least one weekend during the summer, and they have these cool boats that are electric boats. They only go 5 miles an hour.
Cool.
And kids are not allowed to drive them. Right. And I'm like, you do see that once we go around that corner, the people who rent the boat can't see us. And my husband's like, it's the rules. What if there's cameras on a lake?
Yeah. This is my husband. Mm-hmm. Yes. And I'm like, I'm going to roll those dice.
No. We go around the corner. I'm like, take the steering wheel, baby. Here we go. Yeah.
Oh my God. I love it. Oh, I love it. You are doing such deeply important work. And, you know, the like tagline at Seed is the future is emotionally intelligent. And the reality is, like, I don't think that any one of us is capable of doing this all on our own. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even the method is called the collaborative emotion processing method. We believe that emotions are processed in community and collaboratively. So much about what you're doing just hits my soul so deeply. And I'm really, really, really freaking grateful that you are in the space.
Thank you. I feel like the first time I was working in the center of my calling was when I was a high school teacher.
Mm.
And then I left that for economic reasons.
Sure.
And have spent 20 years trying to find work that was at the center of my passion again, and then finally stumbled into it through this really intense crisis, awful journey that I talked about, and that led us into this place where I learned some things and created some things that I thought I could share with other people. And
the best part is I'm all of the work I'm doing mirrors the journey that I'm still on, right? I'm still figuring stuff out. I still screw things up all the time.
Yeah.
Right? And so I'm in this very privileged place to be, again, working at the center of my passion right now. And it is wonderful to be able to connect with kindred souls in the space. I was mentioning to you before that I had stumbled upon your website during some Google search a year ago. And then I have this amazing strategy of just keeping tabs open to read later. And then there, of course, there's always some tech problem. And then I closed 20 tabs at one time, so never got back to it. And so when you invited me to be on this podcast, I said, wait, this is something. This is tickling a memory. And so it's great to be back with you,
you,
and to be have the opportunity to learn more about the incredible work that you're doing.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it takes a village. It's the Voices of Your Village podcast. The village well parenting makes sense to me. And we need all the voices in the village. So thank you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. I also listened to your podcast and heard that you had a conference in April. So make sure I know about your conference for next year, because that sounds incredible.
I was just after this going to say, like, do you want to come be one of our speakers?
Oh, totally.
Yeah,
totally.
Great. Okay,
speaking
great.
And learning. Yeah.
Great. Where can folks connect with you, learn more about what you're doing, find you, all that jazz?
The first podcast I was on, they asked me this question. I had no idea what my socials were. So
obsessed.
I am now prepared.
So prepared.
Yes. So the best way is to subscribe to our every other week newsletter, Morning Cup of Calm. And that's on my website, villagewellparenting.com. I am on most socials as at Village Well Parenting, with the exception of TikTok, where I'm a little more funky and it's Queer Brown Dad.
Sick. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for tuning in to Voices of Your Village. Check out the transcript at voicesofyourvillage.com. Did you know that we have a special community over on Instagram hanging out every day with more free content? Come join us at seed.and.sow, S-E-W. Take a screenshot of you tuning in, share it on the gram, and tag seed.and.sow to let me know your key takeaway. If you're digging this podcast, make sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. We love collaborating with you to raise emotionally intelligent humans.
Well, hey there, busy mama. Are you looking for ways to make your life easier, your home less chaotic, and at the same time, add more joy to your life? My name is Deanna Yates, and I'm the host of Wanna Be Clutter-Free, a podcast all about letting go of the stuff we don't need in our lives so that we can focus on what truly matters. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you to throw it all away or make you feel guilty about keeping something you love, no matter how many other people don't quite understand it. But I will give you practical and, more importantly, actionable advice so that you can make progress right away. And you won't just hear it from me. There are amazing guests too. It's like having your bestie in your pocket telling you it's okay to let go of the things that are not serving you and your family in a totally non-judgmental way. So join me over on the podcast where we can work on progress over perfection for those of us that want to be clutter-free.